What is the one myth that most people get wrong about the business of entertainment?
From a Nigerian African context, they think it's a business of amusement. Everything from a global perspective, they think it's a cultural charade. So when you think about Nigeria today, you would say, oh, they're the Afrobeat people. But 20 years ago, it was they're the 419 people.
Do you think we've done a good job of exporting all our culture, or you still think there's gaps?
I haven't even started.
Aldo Maikori. Before Afrobeats became a global export, Aldo co-founded Chocolate City, a label that helped shape the sound of a generation. From M.I. Abaga to Jesse Jacks to Ice Prince, Chocolate City didn't just produce hits, it built culture.
You've been in this game from almost inception. Do you believe that from a label perspective or from like a business perspective, things are a little bit more structured versus when you first started?
If you look at revenues for most record labels today, you'll see that at least 70% of the revenue is not from Nigeria. We have a situation where we have built an industry on somebody else's infrastructure. If Spotify says, well, guys, it was nice, I'm not, then where do we sell? YouTube? Oh, yes, Leo Cohen will say, well, guys, we don't want you. Then where do you go to? So if you keep going, we have nothing.
And do you think the Nigerian music is an industry or a hustle? We see the tweets, and every single day what we see is we love Afropolitan. This podcast is underrated. This is the best podcast ever. But the problem is 82% of you are not subscribers, but I know you guys are watching. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Thank you. Aju, so someone's going to click into your specific video, and they may be going on a road trip. They may be winding down from a long day. They may even be just simply working out. So the first thing I want you to tell the Afropolitan audience is, what is the one myth that most people get wrong about the business of entertainment?
I think it depends on where. If you're talking about from a Nigerian African context, they think it's a business of amusement. Everything from a global perspective, they think is a cultural charade, right? And they're both wrong, because if you dig deeper into it, it's really about a manifestation of yourself, which is actually your culture, which even though it's not static, for a long time, is probably the most sustained version of yourself, wherever it's manifested.
And do you think we've done a good job of exporting all our culture in Nigeria, or you still think there's gaps?
I haven't even started. I don't think we've even started at all. But I think that there's a seismic shift in the perception and in how people receive, you know, the sectors as a whole. You know, there was a remix, creativity, culture, what's the word? Customs, convention. Like, these are all sort of like how we perceive people. So when you think about Nigeria today, you would say, oh, they're the Afrobeat people. Or they say, oh, they like to dress fancy. Or they will say, oh, they know how to throw parties. But 20 years ago, it was they're the 419 people. Right? True. They're the ones who are the prince. Oh, you're Prince Aldo. Okay, you're a scam artist, you know? And whether we like it or not, it's part of the culture, right? That's the culture that people look at you and think, this is what you are based off of what is the most popular thing that you find. But now I think there's a huge diversification, but I don't think we've been, I hate this word, intentional in exporting the culture. But the other guys have done it very intentionally. We dress like Americans. Sometimes we sound like we're British. Then we have some French tastes. You know, it's a mix. And that's the word, a mixed culture. So I think we need to be actively pushing the kaftans. You know, actively pushing Eba as a staple that you can get. And suya, the same thing where you go to a burger joint anywhere in this world, you can buy suya somewhere else.
I think for me, Aldo, one of the reasons I was looking forward to having you on the podcast was you've been in this game from almost inception at this point to here, right? I think what I wanted to get your thoughts on is, do you believe that from a label perspective or from like a business perspective, things are a little bit more structured versus when you first started? The reason why I'm asking this is in 2019, 2020, 2021, a lot more quote unquote private equity folks came into the game. Some corporate venture folks came into the game and they put some financing behind like companies like Maven, even Chocolate City. And I remember at the time, like looking from San Francisco, I'm like, ah, this money they're putting in looks small compared to the value that Chocolate City has created, or Maven has created, or even Mohit or whoever's created, like Don Jazzy or Aldo or the whole team. And obviously, I've gone on to raise then and understood the mechanics now. But at the time, before you understood the game, what did you feel about that?
So what about how much they put in relative to value created?
Yes, because even there, when I think about a Don Jazzy or I think about a Chocolate City, the money that they put in, some of it is like maybe 1 point something or 2 million or 3 million. Like, you guys for the last 10, 15 years have generated multiples of that, right? Yeah. So if we're talking about the actual value created that has not necessarily been captured, you guys have generated multiples of that, right? So at the time though, and I think this is a conversation from I had one of the execs, it was like, yeah, we might have generated that value, but were our books like clean, or were our books structured in a way that, where if somebody's coming to invest, they can say, okay, cool, here are my P&L statements, here's my balance statement, here's my income statement. So the reason why I was asking is two-part question. Do you believe that the pricing at the time reflected the value that had been created, number one? But number two, do you think it's better, much more structured now?
Yeah, so in Chocolate City's case, we've always had our books. We've always been the most structured company from inception, because we didn't just jump into our company is not a label. Many people talk about Chocolate City like it's just a record label. It's not. Chocolate City has a record label, but it was always going to be a multimedia entertainment company. And therefore, that helped us absorb the shocks and the lack of, shall I say, liquidity in the industry when many companies were folding. If you look at the generation of labels over 20 years, we're the only one standing and still very relevant, still making a profit. And that's simply because the structure was always different. So we were careful about our books, the records, contracts. That was always deliberate. So that wasn't it. I mean, even at the time that we did the Warner deal, we're doing at least $1.5, $2 million a year. So that wasn't, the play was not really about the money. The play really was about the access to a broader global conversation. Because the truth is that if you look at revenues for most record labels today, you'll see that at least 70% of the revenue is not from Nigeria. It's ex-Africa. So you find that it's not that you can't make the money in Nigeria, but the truth is that it does not register internationally. There's a lot of information that people don't have. There's a lot of information gaps. I'll give an example. You have, under Nigerian law, I'm going to say some boring legal stuff now, but under Nigerian law, once you create an artwork and it's fixed in the medium, the law confers the copyright upon you. You don't have to register it. But the truth is that in America, if you don't register in America, you own nothing. Now, if the exploitation is happening in the U.S., and you have a Nigerian copyright registration, they don't recognize you. So the question then is that how many of these great songs that Nigerians created are actually owned by Nigerians in the international, especially when in terms of monetization ownership? Many of them don't have that. We discovered this, something that should have been obvious, but it wasn't obvious because as far as we're concerned, this is a Nigerian product. But no, what we've done is created a global product which is exported around the world. We just did 1 billion streams on Love One Ting Ting a few days ago, but we registered that in the US. If it's not registered in the US, there's no conversation. Whatever you've done is owned by whichever entity can lay claim to it in the States. So I'll say that's the first thing. The second thing around whether the amount was adequate or not is that it was an injection, but a partnership. So it's part of that partnership that allowed us to be able to exploit Love Wanting in multiple markets and spend a couple of $1 million in pushing that song, because you need to spend money promoting that. So we'll say that that deal wasn't necessarily done for that. It was done because there was a bigger play. At the end of the day, a company must sort of exit or implode, right, at some point in time. So it was a path to an exit, or at least a proposed exit that would create bigger value and create a global company as compared to just a local player. Now, is it better structured now? Definitely. But that is a function of the information that we have. one thing I think that people don't also realize is that when it comes to company valuations and things like that, you would know that. You guys would know that.
Yeah.
That when you say you're doing something in Nigeria, there's a huge risk.
Yep.
There's a fundamental risk that can cut off 30, 40% as a discount of that company. So in as while you can value, okay, another problem. So let's say our catalog maybe 8 years ago was a couple of thousand songs. But how many of those songs at the time were registered in America? None.
Mm.
So when you're trying to do a valuation, it's still a Nigerian copyright thing. Do you know what I'm saying? So right now, there's no doubt that we've done all those registrations or we've learned those lessons. But that automatically, so when you're saying, what's the company? The value of the company is the catalog. The catalog is what? Not understood or recognized in the States. So the valuation is what? Automatically lower. So the bigger risk for companies to put money, as you guys well know, in Nigeria, especially when it's not traditional fintech, when it's brick and mortar, when it's still, like this 2019 before Afrobeat really blew. So you also have to understand too, at that time, they're like, we're taking a risk on you. Now, prior to that, we had one or two investors, but we're very careful about who we took money from. And what would happen is that they all didn't believe in the deal, in the company, in what we're doing. So you find that it's much harder to raise money locally. Again, I'm sure you guys know.
Yeah.
I listened to one of your episodes when you're talking about what you guys learned, and that was quite informative. So, So you'd say that at the time they were taking a risk that local companies would not take. And when you think about like the Maven deal that culminated, or rather was consummated last year, it was after going through those steps to got to a point where we're like, okay, you guys are now bona fide, we're going to do that. And the question then is that how many Nigerian companies could give that $150 million? There are quite a few, bro. There's a guy who walked into this room and said, $150 million? They'll bring it in cash. But they still do not understand.
Dynamics.
So for them, it's a no-no.
What role do you, because I also did law school, I just didn't end up practicing because, you know, I realized that it wasn't for me. But what role do you think having a legal background plays, especially in this sort of business environment? Because sometimes, you know, we talk to music folks and that structure is not always there. But from a triaging perspective, what role do you believe like having a legal background enabled you to navigate this landscape? Because like you said, you've started something, you're dealing with creatives. A lot of creatives don't sometimes want structure or like structure.
Yeah.
And so what role do you believe that the legal background has helped in
it's shaping? Everything.
Yeah.
It's everything. I mean, if you think about entertainment law in Nigeria, probably, well, I was one of the earliest people in that space. When I was pivoting, I remember that I was, because I used to work with Afep Abalola SAN, which is a top litigation law firm. Big cases, very, just always about the courts and stuff like that. And I was looking for mentors, and there are only two names that popped up. It was Toyin Subair, a big bro mentor to me as well, and Efe Ozako. And he did something called Waiting Lawyers, They Do Sef. He had a series. This is like 2005, 2006. Those were the only people that were doing entertainment law. But they were not really doing core music-related stuff. So I was blessed. I come from a family of lawyers. My father was an attorney. My brother's an attorney. My sister did something in criminology. My cousin. So we have a history in that. I grew up watching my father. He had this volume. It's called Entertainment Industry Contracts. He bought this when I was 11 or 12. So I don't think there are many lawyers at all looking at that sector in 86 in entertainment. So I grew up also watching that. Obviously, it was something very prized because the boxes that they came in, they were shipped from, you know. So I like, I opened it, I saw entertainment, I saw TV, then I saw music, then I saw publishing. I was like, man, when I grow older, I really want to read this to understand a bit more about that. And so I was lucky to already have the books that helped me draft to understand the industry. Then I had the innate interest in music as well because I was playing the keyboard by 11. We had a music teacher. So my father and my family were very music heavy. So they encouraged us to explore that. So that combination helped me figure out not just the understanding of music itself, not just about how music should sound, but now being, curious about how to protect what you've created. Right. So that was very important. So that even as early as 2005, when we started, We started off with record contracts that were world class. Well, world class as can be adaptable here, but we had all the things. I mean, one of the first clients that I dealt with was a guy who had a contract that had no termination date. Literally. He signed his life away and he told me. So he showed me the contract. I said, no, man, this is not. And I got him out of his contract. So that's like one of the early things I did. The first artist you signed, Jeremiah Gang, he had a contract as well. And the contract was nonsense. And we just wrote one letter and they had to dismiss because the point. So the litigation background helped me a lot. AFE is very technical, very, very technical. You find that most cases we resolve before going to court. Mm-hmm. Just one letter, some attachments. And you're just like, this doesn't really good. So you back down. So that helped. And then I think the other thing that was also crucial too was that many people were just taking, you can take a contract and just write anything on it, but you don't understand what is behind it.
Yeah.
Do you get what I'm saying? So, but one thing that we did was with the first artist that we signed, we said, look, if you're not happy about anything in the contract, come back. And we did adjust the terms a couple of times because the idea then was that we're both sort of learning. The industry is in flux. We're not getting money from your royalties. We're not selling any music online. We're literally just hoping that you get endorsement, you get show. That was the revenue streams. And TJ will give you some money to shoot videos, but he'll never account to you how much you're making. So the legal background was very, very important because even when people were like, the first artist we had, he went and was trying to get out of his contract. And everybody came back. And so I soon got a very bad reputation in the industry. Like, I'll do now. If Chuck Leslie gives you a contract now, don't even try yourself. You're going nowhere. Because we're ready. We could back it up with the court. And we're not afraid to take that action because we understood that that was exactly the problem. The problem is that if people feel that they can get out of the contract just because they cry about it, then who's going to invest? Which was always the problem about the investment itself, is that how do you enforce your contracts when a social media tweet gets you out of a contract? You know, so I think it was very critical. My, because remember, the Chocolatey is three of us. I always tell people it's not me. I just happened to be the one, you know, who was driving it, so CEO. But my brother Yahya is a lawyer as well. And there's Paul Okugo, who was a marketing and sales expert. And the idea then was like, we all knew that we brought different things to the table. I had more experience in litigation and understanding contracts, commercial law, because my practice experience. My brother was more around the broad vision and just visioning what we needed to be and just guidance and, you know, had a lot of contacts as well. And Paul was great at understanding the market and being able to kind of drive products. So that trio actually helped us build something that most people didn't have at that time.
Etcher, remember that time I walked into a bank, I'm not going to give the name, and I asked them for $1,000 and they told me no, they cannot withdraw any dollar for me. And I was so upset. And I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have V-Band to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have V-Band as a sponsor for the Afropolitan podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast.
You know, the other part I wanted to talk about, and this is now in hindsight, right? Technology infrastructure. So something that the West tends to have is their ability to capture the value that they have created, right? And you and I have had multiple conversations about this. Looking back, because I connected with Ike Orizu. And I don't know if you remember Ike. Sport Radio. Way before Pandora, way before even Apple Music. But this was Nigerian products, right?
Yeah.
And at the time, it might not have been something that maybe a lot of people in the industry understood. But when you look back now, and because since then, the music folks have now connected with the technology folks, have connected with the finance folks. There's now much more intermixing of multidisciplinary, mental models, right? if you could now go back, what role could a true sport have played, knowing now that the reason that they discount us is we don't have the metrics, we don't have the KPIs, we don't have the bucket that captures it, so that when they come, they can just plug in and say, okay, cool, this is how many streams, how many numbers, whatever. What role does the sort of technology infrastructure, what role could I have played back then in helping capture the value that the ecosystem was generating at scale? What do you think about that now in hindsight?
I mean, I'd rather respond like this. I think is what role can that play today?
Today, yes.
I wouldn't talk about the past because we didn't have infrastructure. Where's the bandwidth? Do you know what I'm saying? How many people were? You had phones that the screens were this small. Do you know what I'm saying? So there was, it was a bit, it was ahead of its time. And I find that if you look at the industry, there are many ahead of the time, ahead of its timers. There was, what's the other streaming platform?
Like
Spinlet.
Spinlet.
You know, Spinlet. And when we did some stuff with Spinlet, there was, even with Etisalat, we, there's a platform that we created together. What's it called? Seven something. I can't remember what it was. But it was all ahead of its time because the market wasn't ready. But I would say that if there's something that should come out of this conversation is what a true sport could do today. We have a situation where we have built an industry on somebody else's infrastructure. We own nothing. Today, if Spotify says, well, guys, it was nice, I'm not, then where do we sell? YouTube? Oh, I guess Leo Cohen will say, well, guys, we don't want you. Then where do you go to? MTN? Well, the guys in South Africa are like, well, guys, it was nice. So if you keep going, we have nothing. So the Ikorizus and I think that there needs to be a strong marriage between media and entertainment in the right spaces, right? Facebook, all these platforms, they are streaming music. They're streaming platforms, like it or not. You shoot a story, put some music, it's streaming. They're all streams. But what do we own? We have nothing.
You know, it's so funny you say this because literally, I don't know if you saw the news about TikTok has restricted lives in Nigeria.
Yeah, but you know why though? By the way, I just heard about it yesterday. I didn't even know about it. I was just like, oh my God. This is so...
Yeah, because me too, I had to dig like first, like, because no one said at first why. And then when I saw why, I said, well, I understand. I understand. But it goes back to what you're saying, right? Because at the end of the day, America does the same thing, right? Yeah. But they could do it because they own it, right? So I think that's really an interesting point. And I think one question I had, it might be a little controversial, is do you think the Nigerian music is an industry or a hustle?
It has become an industry.
Okay.
By the hustle.
Mm.
Right? Because... what is a hustle on structured, focused on the immediate reward system? And an industry is more long-term and it kind of has a, shall I say, an ecosystem effect. But it has to start from the hustle. And the hustle is some guy that picks up the phone and says, a mic and says, I can rap or I can sing or whatever. And then people start adoring him. And then he needs a stylist. Then he needs a... you know, so it's almost like what you guys have created now, for example, in Afropolitan. And I remember when it was a hustle.
Yeah. And you'd always say transition from the hustle.
You always have to. Yeah. And a good example of that is Linda Ekeji and Bella Naija. I use that, those examples a lot.
Can you really break that down? Because not all our audience may know those two platforms.
Okay, so Linda KG is, or was, the top blog in Nigeria. It's similar to what EdNot is today, but just on its own, it's syndicated, but primarily it had its own little blog page. It was on blog.spot.
She didn't own her domain, which was one issue.
And then Bella Naija had this structure and they were both doing the same thing at a point in time. But what Bella did was that she created a structure and hired people. And after a while, she started moving back to create this thing. And Linda was, I mean, if you look at her business model, it was brilliant. It was a typical hustle. And I think Tunde Adnet was in that same space. And we had a talk with him a couple of years ago and I told him the same story. And I said, look, at the end of the day, you have to grow up. Not those words. But every business must grow up. It is nice for you guys. I mean, right now you guys are the faces of this, but right now you have a whole team, a whole system that works. You're growing up. Otherwise, you can't still be taking the phones, running up and down and all that. And Linda had a three-man team, her and the two sisters, paid no rent, rented no offices. And at some point in time, she was generating something like 21 million naira a month.
At the time.
What?
Yeah. This 2013, 14.
That's real money back then.
And that is at 120, maybe 110
yeah.
to the dollar. So just do the math. And at the same time, at Chocolate City, we have, because we diversified our business as way back as 2000 and maybe 9 or 10. So we actually were doing digital marketing for a bunch of companies. We had a lot of companies that were our clients. So we had a whole digital team and they were creating, curating and helping them do stuff. And we're generating maybe 4 or 5 million naira at the time for the hustle. So one day I sat down with the social media team with like 7 of them. Like, I think we're just wasting money, you guys. This lady is generating 3 times what you're doing with less effort. I'm paying rent. I'm paying you. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. But I remember we had a talk with her one time and I was saying, well, this sounds amazing, but I think there are a few things you have to do. And I was more of the copywriting, trademarks, blah, 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 which she later did. But I think there was also the intermission between that time. I think it took a bit too much time for her to transit. And sometimes it's hard when you're getting a lot of cash flow for you to see that, look, at the end of the day, this will not always be like that. I think everybody needs to know that. That
cannibalize that yourself.
You will, or you'll be cannibalized by them. Because there's someone out there replacing you every day.
Yeah.
Or looking to.
No, there's someone replacing you. No, they're not looking to.
Yeah.
They are. Because as you sit down, think about Blockbuster and Netflix. The Netflix is about to be replaced, by the way. YouTube is going to screw up Netflix. And there's another company. So if, and even it's not true, if you go with the mentality that you are going to be old news soon, it helps you make decisions really quickly, which is what Kodak didn't do. And they ended up having a husk of a company with just the logo because they didn't move quickly with digital tech. So if you look at what, Bella Naija did was that she moved away and created these things. So she focused on the premium brand while Linda was very focused on the hot news. And she made a ton of money. No doubt that she probably made more money by far over Bella. But today, when you think about the brand and where corporates will put their money, so I don't think there's one that was better. I think it's what are you after? Mm-hmm. What are you creating? You know, it's like the iMac, or should I say the Apple and Google. What's
Android.
The iOS and yeah. Android model. No, actually, more about the Apple brand as compared to, say,
Samsung or
a Google thing. Yeah, Google is cheaper, faster, blah, 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 and more accessible. Apple said, no, we're not playing that. If you buy my product, you know that I'm a premium product seller.
Aspirational,
and we're going to keep this brand. We're going to keep people. And when you look at the market cap, you'll find that Toyota is probably a bigger, not Toyota, Android is a bigger market overall. But just because Apple has created this perceived value, it was actually one of the most valuable companies in the world.
It's trillion.
So I don't think there's one that's better. I think it's just really what it is. So back to the hustle, whether it's hustle or not, is that you have to start the hustle, then get into the industry. And today we're in the industry because look at all the great things that are happening right now. The only problem is that we need to find a way to make sure that people are paid across the value chain, not just the entertainers, but everyone within it. And I think the award system might be responsible for that. We only give awards to Artist of the Year. We don't give to the Sound Engineer of the Year or the person who wrote the song. You know,
One other question I wanted to understand is, because we're talking a lot about the industry, the infrastructure. I'm curious, as someone who has, I think, done a good job of zooming out, what do you think is opportunity today that we may be missing?
Do we have no time for this?
Yeah.
There's so much. So are we talking about the creative sector?
Yeah. Or maybe there's other sectors, you know, because again, this is a podcast that have a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of even diasporans are like, okay, how do I enter Nigeria? How do I, you know, what's the opportunity? So maybe there's other things you have seen as well.
Yeah. I mean, so let me just talk broadly around the creative sector for the purpose of this podcast. I think that, you know, as you all know, your businesses for entrepreneurs, the problem is the opportunity. The way I've always looked at things is that, what is the problem? Is it interesting enough for me to solve? Do I have the bandwidth, the capacity to solve that problem? Is it exciting enough for me to risk my time to do it? And once it's a yes, 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 then I will find a way to intervene in a small way. But that's the story of America. America is the story of entrepreneurs. It's not about government. It was always entrepreneurs. Remember, Rockefeller was funding the government at some point in time. Just being very, very
focused
on fixing infrastructural things, and almost in a way that seems he's overwhelming the market. But it's simple. He just has looked at the problems and said, look, I'm going to fix this problem. Yesterday, he said, I am cutting the price of petrol. Simple. He also the thing. Some guy says, look, this guy is spending this amount of money. And that is sometimes the opportunity, I think. The opportunity is that there's so many problems that need to be fixed. And many of us are busy complaining instead of finding the solution to that problem, because therein lies the money. Yeah. Look across the sector. Let's talk about data. Who's actually mining data? Who's mining data today to help investors make better decisions in the country? Who?
Maybe like Stairs, but that's maybe like one. So, yeah.
Is that enough?
No.
You know, we're at the event. No, were you guys at the Harvard thing?
No, not this year.
They
did a local one. Yeah, listening tour. For the Harvard people.
The listening tour. So we were backstage. So we did a town hall. So I was running like the town hall. Just something like this. What are the opportunities that can, something like that. So it was quite interesting. And I was talking to Janet. Janet manages Asha. You know, Janet also. And I've known them for a long time. Because I at a point in time, I was representing Asha as a lawyer in 2005-06. So I was just like, man, Jenna, you know, you're older than me in the industry. Although I'm older than you by age. She's like, yes, you know, people call her Auntie Janet. I said, some old woman, but really she's a young lady. I said, yeah, because you've been in the industry for a while. And then it occurred to me that she started off as a photographer, right? And we're just talking about events, and somebody's saying, oh, I haven't seen a Asha perform for a while, blah, blah, blah. And she said, you know, Nigerians have this crab in the bucket mentality. Is that they'll tell you, oh, you know, Thames is taking Asha's market. Or, you know, not TY is something we aim at. Like, there's always comparisons. Meanwhile, in a place like Paris, 2,500 events happen every day. Mm. I said, no. I said, this is impossible. Shit.
Go look.
Facts.
Yeah.
How many people are in Paris? Are they 10 million? No. Lagos is 20 million people and counting. How many events happen here? Opportunity. The person who can now create these events, even if it's at gate prices, you know, 10 naira, I don't know, whatever that price is, there's money to be made. There's data to be collected. And there are projections to be made off of that data, which is sellable to the third party who's trying to get into market. Nigeria is 36 states. Do you know that all the budget for MTN and the telcos, 80% is concentrated in this part of the country? Meanwhile, Kaduna, Kano, Sokoto have the biggest population. There's no one to create the content, the platforms for them to be able to use that dollar, the mark, not dollars, the naira to market, because you don't have the data, right? Think about fashion. The biggest opportunity in Nigeria, I think, is distribution.
Yeah.
And it means it cuts across literally everything. I like your hat. How can I get this hat? One tailor in Balogun. Okay. Yeah. All right. Can you send me his WhatsApp?
Yeah, I'll give you his WhatsApp. That's it. Yeah.
I send the WhatsApp. The tailor said, I don't know his number. So that's, he has lost that business. Meanwhile, if I ask you the same question in LA, you tell me, go to JJ.com or Amazon, put the code, and they'll ship it to you immediately. We can't get products to people. We can't get music to people. The platforms we're talking about is distribution. We don't own it. We don't have it. We're talking about clothes. This is a beautiful dress. I want to buy it for my wife. How am I going to get this thing? Oh, well, you know.
It's always a story.
There's a story somewhere.
It's always a story.
Right? So the question is, who's fixing getting the product to the people. How do I sell tickets for a concert without you coming there and know that when you get there, there's a scanner that will allow you to walk into space seamlessly? How is Dirty December? Yeah, they said $2 million. How much was it? Bro, it could be 5-6 times that amount of money. But nobody has... I think we talked about this.
We talked about this a while ago. Yeah.
Who is booking the tickets to fly in here? My cousin called me earlier. He said, I need a car for 6 days for the December. We have a couple of cars lying down the compound doing nothing. The Nigerian mentality was like, I need my car for Kabu Kabu. The American mentality was like, how much?
Two row.
So there's so many of them. Like, what we all we have to do is just live here and the opportunities pop up very clearly. But the problem again is risk aversion. We're very averse to risk. People aren't ready to put money in the space. Many years ago, I heard that someone wanted to buy Arsenal. A billionaire wanted to buy, I think it was one of these African guys. I'm like, okay, but bro, this ranch is bees. This ranch is bees. I had a talk with someone very recently. We were talking about sports. And she runs a sports channel. And just talking about like the local league. The average attendance for local shows in Nigeria is 2,000-3,000 people. In a stadium that can take 50,000 people, 20,000 people. Then one random match happened, 42,000 people showed up. Now, if Ranchers Bees is playing Afropolitan United today, and I can sell Afropolitan t-shirts to 10%, that's 4,000 t-shirts every week or every 2 weeks. There's a Coca-Cola product that I need to drink or water that can be sold in that place. 42,000 people will definitely want to buy. Even if they can all afford it, let's just say another 20% will be thirsty and they'll say, you know what, just give me the damn water, right? Then there is the idea of having a halftime show and getting someone to come and perform. And, you know, the new artist on my label that has never been known by people, all of a sudden he sings a song that's local and he's taken up. Yeah. All of a sudden somebody picks him and says, yo, can you be our mascot for Ginger Bet or Bet Niger? So there's... Guys, there's just too much. But let's fix how we get products to people and services.
What would you say, because obviously you've spent time around the world in a lot of these similar industries, right? What would you say from a hip-hop perspective as some of the similarities between hip-hop and Afrobeats? What would you also say are some of the differences? Because again, you and I have had so many conversations about this, just now bringing our audience into this conversation. But what would you say are some of the similarities you've observed and mistakes that we also made that we shouldn't necessarily have made because we should have been looking at what they did? And what are the opportunities that we have that they might not have had?
I mean, so someone said that hip-hop was a hustle. Afrobeat is a hustle, especially now. The original... And I don't like the word Afrobeat, to be honest. I think it's too generic and doesn't encompass everything. Because when I think about African music, in Nigeria alone, highlife music for me is authentically our music. Afrobeat is very, very...
pop. Well,
not just... No, I don't have a problem with pop. I think it's very buffet type. You know, a bit of this, a bit of that. You know, so it's a buffet style meal. Meanwhile, highlife is... originals like Pound of Yam with a la carte, you know. So that's what you see a lot with hip hop. Hip hop really was an expression of frustration and swag, and Afrobeat is more of a cultural expression. Then now it's a bit more about swag, and people are like, you know what? If I get one song and I can do streaming, so it's now become a hustle. But it's now become a profession because now you can actually make money from it. Think about the royalty play. The royalties can pay forever and ever if you have the right setup. So it's now become that. So those are similarities. The dissimilarities, I think, is that hip hop was built as a lifestyle and Afrobeat has not incorporated the lifestyle into it.
I agree.
But in a way, it's all there. Right. If every musician wears kaftan, cap, you know, the women are dancing a bit more culturally or at least incorporating some, you would see a bit of that. But there's no hip-hop gear. There's no Afrobeat gear. Right? That's why Afrobeat is not... That's why the word doesn't really sit well. I'll just say African Renaissance culture. If that what I would call it. I wouldn't call it Afrobeat because the culture has to do with different variations. Like different... There's Fuji still happening. Adekunle goes doing some kind of Fuji. There's Altair. We created Altair. Altair is actually neo soul meets high life African. So I think the opportunities hip hop didn't have was that hip hop was quickly owned by the white man.
Very quickly.
Yeah, they swooped it sharp.
But do you know why? They have the data. Black people don't have the data. Afrobeats is also getting cannibalized in that way because they have the data. We don't have the data. And until we have the data, and that's why platforms are important. You know, if I was going to leave a sermon today, it's just really about the platform, about owning the platform. Because the platform gives you guys tech guys, you will know exactly where the sales are happening and they will move quickly and throw money at that opportunity while we are watching and saying, what's happening? You know, so they're also moving very quickly. We need to educate our people because hip hop didn't educate their people. They didn't have the information. Like when you hear about royalties and publishing and black boxes, when you hear about movie credits and there's a...
Sinks.
But even the movie industry, how many of these actors actually had a percentage in... I think it was maybe Will Smith. There's someone who was the first guy to get a back end on the movie. Gross, I can't remember who it was now. But most of us didn't know about the back end. Mm. So it's okay, $500,000 ticket. But you made $150 million box office hit. You didn't have the information. The production companies are owned by who? White people.
Yeah.
So what we have that's uniquely our advantage is that we don't have the white man inside and controlling the system.
Yet.
Like in a place like South Africa. Yet. Yet. Yeah. And that's why we have to move quickly to educate, empower. In fact, we have to institutionalize the sort of like ownership structure in a way that protects our future. Because look, the white man enslaved the black man for 400 years, but intellectual property enslavement is in perpetuity.
Wow.
So we're going to be slaves forever. They're going to own what we've done forever. We have to protect that because that is us. That's our soul. They took our body. This time is going to be our soul.
I have some follow up with that. Well, number one, I 100% agree with this white man thing because we were in Accra and we saw a white man. I'm not going to name the show they're part of. Mm. And he was running around trying to figure out what's going on, you know. And that actually made me wake up, you know, like I think this was like 2-3 years ago. And I was like, they're seeking us, you know. So we need to get real like quick about, you know, how we want to play this. But I think the other, you know, question, just going back to hip hop, is, you know, we're coming up 50 years, right? Is hip hop dead?
Where?
I mean, it's a global sound, right? It literally is everywhere. I think there's been this interesting tension because, for example, was it the NBA All-Star game last year? And, you know, I think for the first time, it was like, was it David O? There was like major like artists, right? Like, yeah, or Rema. There was someone. And I'm seeing it, you know, it's being put in the Grammys, but also like it's just quietly being put in. And so people are like this, this music is being taken over. And I'm wondering, like, does it need reinvention or is it just, you know, it's an era and now we're moving on?
And they're saying this year too, no hip hop song has been like
Number one. Yeah, I heard. So me, I'm a hip hop head to the core. I think what I love the most about hip hop is the jazz sampling. It's just the underpinning that is the fact that there's all sorts of sounds that you probably wouldn't have listened to because you snore off. But hip hop now, and allows you to listen to 3 or 4. I mean, when you think about sampling, just the brilliance of how you take a sound from here and you mix that. And I think that's what hip hop is missing, is that it is, I hate with all my life. I repeat this. I hate with all my life. What's that thing that they call it? That trap music? Trap music, as the name connotes, trapped hip hop.
Really?
They've been trapped for the past 10, 15 years. Listen to hip hop for the past 15 years, the same sound.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, if you look at the era of the 70s, the 80s, mid-'85s, 90s, 95, you can see the...
Early
2000s. Early. I mean, even to a large extent, up to like 2010.
Yeah, I was literally about to say that, 2010.
It was chill.
Yeah, when I graduated from college.
We had these guys talking about nothing. The sound is monotonous. So I just don't know what happened. And then that is where it stopped. But when you hear, the reason why Afrobeat is popping up, and you know, there's a debate. Are we selling out? Are we buying in? You know, people are kind of confused, right? But I think that Afrobeat brings to you, again, a different variations, expressions of a culture, right? And hip hop has stopped doing that. So hip hop, if you look at the past 3-4 years, old hip hoppers are now releasing albums, and they're still better than what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
They're still better than what you're hearing now. Of course, they don't have the same audience because they're older, so people don't even relate to them. But if you go and listen to
Clips album, phenomenal.
Look, like the rollout, the brilliant. Like, and we know what you're saying, guys. We don't know what the hell you're talking about.
They say mumble rap. That's what we're hearing. Mumble
honestly,
rap.
It's so frustrating. Like when you and so now I spend more time listening to old stuff. I'm not interested in new stuff because there's nothing to hear. It's the same beat with different people jumping on it.
It's just Jay-Z for me, top to bottom, all the albums. That's all I can listen to. Yeah.
Jay-Z, have you heard of A Tribe Called Quest?
Of course.
That is the greatest hip-hop group, rap group ever, as far as I'm concerned. No disrespect to Wu-Tang. But it's not what made the Quest very... In fact, Quest is one of the... Probably 70% of the reason why I did music was that I realized that I was learning from their music. I had a great experience, but the fact that it could change mindsets, because they came in time when people were doing young gangster rap, and they said, look, we can talk about Bonita's bum. We can talk about the enslavement of Steve Biko. They talk about different things. And what I like the most was the first rap group to mention Nigeria in a rap song. So I'm like, oh, wow, Nigeria. When we were booty scratchers and stuff like that, they're the first guys to mention that. But so, yeah, so I think hip-hop is dead. They need a revival.
You know, one of the first books I read in hip-hop that still stayed with me today is The Tanning of America by Steve Stout, right?
Yeah.
And when I read that book, I think it just gave a really great explanation of like the history and how it started and the influence it's had, right? When I now read that book, and I remember the song that came out that year was Cash App by Bella Smarter, right? Mm-hmm. I remember saying to myself, it's so funny, this is the biggest Afrobeat song of the year. There's an actual company called Cash App. If this was in America, Bella was minted, right? Yeah, and I was not saying to myself, like, these are the challenges that we have where here's a song that literally is the name of your company. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You target, and they target till today, still target minorities and black people. Mm-hmm, that's usually most of the people that use Cash App anyway.
Yeah.
If he was in America, that boy is minted. He might not need to raise another song anymore because the endorsement deal would have been insane.
Yeah.
But in a place like Nigeria, he's not able... And the point of this question is the advertising industry. It really helped shape hip-hop as well, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Steve Stout was able to unlock for that industry, which is like, yes, you can sell albums, you can sell merch, you can sell this, but the advertising industry in America is a $790 billion industry, right? Folks like Jay-Z, folks like, you know, Roc Nation, different guys have understood this business model. Why till today do you feel like that's not necessarily been unlocked in the African ecosystem where you have the music, you have the culture, yes, there are endorsement deals, but at scale, it doesn't seem like there's a perfect marriage between the culture that's moving products. Like obviously Run DMC was moving like the Adidas, Jay has moved like the bottles, the merch, everything, right? Mm-hmm. Why hasn't that necessarily been fully replicated on this side?
Because it still goes back to we're not looking inward, we're looking outward. So I'm excited that Martell brands me. Martell is not a Nigerian company, right? I should be excited that Zobo company brands me, because every day I can sell a bottle of Zobo to 140 million Nigerians and they'll probably buy it. That's the problem with Zobo distribution. I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I want people to understand that we cannot get the product. We've not created the pipeline to deliver the product. That's why we can never capture the product.
And that's why China keeps winning.
We can create value.
Yeah, we create.
As you well know, but that's not the problem. It's how you capture and retain value. And we can't retain the value. So you're talking about advert now. Adidas has data. We have 5,000 stores. When you sell one product, bim, there's some kind of indicator that they've done that. What Nigerian brand has 20 stores of products? Let's say lifestyle products, not food. Call that brand 20 stores.
If it's not a banner, forget about it.
I was
going
to say banner. That was the only thing I could think of.
It's mostly food, groceries.
It's groceries.
And it's not 20 stores. Yeah. In New York, on the same street, you will find 79 Duane Reed's. You'll find 17 CVS's. You'll find 17. You pass Adidas here, and there's an Adidas by the corner. And that's distribution. Now, we agree that the model is dying, but there is Amazon. That's distribution. How do I advertise a product where I can't track how well the sales are doing? Do you know what I'm saying? How do I do that? So, I mean, many years ago, I used to be a brand ambassador for Shivers. And Shivers had been in Nigeria for a while. But they didn't have any product focus. So they had to do an advert. So we did a whole thing whereby we did something called Passion. No, that was different. The Venture.
Yeah, I remember that.
The Venture. So I was like the judge for The Venture. But
is it like a Shark Tank type thing? Or
yes, sort of. But the idea then was connecting success, shared success. So it's not just about being successful. Like, who are you coming? Who's coming with you on the thing? And we did a couple of adverts with Chiwetel, with what's the guy in house? The black actor, really smart guy, funny guy.
Don Cheadle,
yeah, right, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And looking at the stats, they're like, oh well, that whole campaign over the year increased their sales by 10-12%. They could track that. Can Zubo and Co. tell me that if they sold something, because that is the reason why you're going to put more money on the product. We don't have the data. We don't have the pipelines, right? So until we start, so that's one. Number two is that we elevate other people's products above us. There's a Nigerian designer. I mean, there's several of them. Let me be careful before. I have quite a few of my friends. Maya Taffa, for example. Mm. Let me use Maya. Maya has got a flagship store. I don't really know. I just came back, so I'm not really sure how. Maybe he has other stores, but I know that there's one major flagship. I don't know if he has one in Abuja. Right? Africana is the one kind of rolling out. I don't know. You guys need to have him here. He's brilliant. This is an Africana thing. That's a plug-in. This is an Africana outfit, right? And he's opening up in Cote d'Ivoire. He has two, three stores in Abuja. I know he's opening something in Lagos very soon, but he needs a lot of funding to expand. I remember that when I first met him 3-4 years ago, we were talking about how to expand the business and all things like that. And I saw the vision very clearly, is that he's trying to create multiple touch points. I will not buy a kaftan. I'm sure it's like that for many of you without seeing it. Let's be honest. You have to touch it. You have to feel it. Look at the... I can go online, but we're not still there yet. So what I'm saying, that the opportunity in Nigeria is that we're still a very old school type market that's trying to translate into digital. So if you can spend the money and invest in something physical, you will make that. So the guy is making, he's doing great stuff. But imagine if Maya Taffa had 25 stores. Imagine there's this girl, brilliant designer. Her shop is somewhere in VI. Ade something, Ode, oh, I can't remember her name, but she's brilliant. She's next to the Honor, opposite Federal Palace.
Andrea Yama, that's what this is.
This? That's what
Andrea
you're in?
Andrea Yama, yeah.
Ah, plugins. They're going to give you guys money for this show. They're going to make that. So Andrea Yama, she's brilliant. I went to the store, I could not believe what
phenomenal
I saw.
Phenomenal design.
And it's it gives a lifestyle. Like, you walk in there and you're like, you understand her aesthetic, her feeling. And it's beyond just the clothes itself. And she also sells little trinkets too.
And I read somewhere that she made like $6 million, something like that last year or two. Yeah, she's doing well. She needs $50 million to open stores everywhere in Nigeria.
Globally too, globally. Not just in Nigeria.
So when she does a deal with you and says, oh, Chika is, wearing my clothes and you sell exclusively, she's going to see a jump because people are watching Afropolitan. And she can track that data directly because she has a system. So we have to build these systems, guys. We have to. If not, we will never capture that value.
What is the country... So this is my challenge.
Is the country ready? You're going to say that, right?
It's beyond ready. I think we're too poor. Like, I don't... No, hold on. So wait, let me land, right?
I think too poor is crazy.
No, but Tayo said it, right? Tayo said this, so we interviewed...
Which Tayo is this?
Paga.
Okay, right? Okay.
And, it's complicated for me because, like, okay, I'll give you for example. So literally, was it last week?
I went to Imo, right? And they did a huge Imo State economic forum, right? He brought in all these people, all the bank MDs were there, like, and it was basically saying Imo is open to business. And I liked it because I even met people that are not from Imo that are saying, I'm building Imo, which is, we actually need more of that. That's a whole different conversation. But I'm looking around and I'm like, okay, in Oweri, right? Yes, I agree. I'm sure we're at the level where these things make sense. But it's like, once you pass, you have to embassy where I'm from. I don't know if it doesn't, I don't know if it works. I think it's figuring out what are the products that do work in all parts of the country and looking at case studies around that.
Ebano.
Yes, of course. Yeah, like I would want to see more of that.
So let's not do America and Nigeria.
Yeah.
Let's be clear, there's some things that will never sell here. And that's why the research and data is important.
Yeah.
Right? There are basic things Nigerians will wear. So let's talk about fashion.
Well, even your Zuba example was very, very good. Yeah,
that could work. That
could
work.
Because
everywhere.
What he's saying is it's less about, you know, going to get the American brands and trying to force people who can't afford it to buy it. But if you're saying Zuba is 10 cents a day, and maybe they're only doing 100 orders a month, but now your influence, you can now scale it to 100,000. You can literally grow in value with that company. And as that company grows, you also grow well together.
So, bro, Chicken Republic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know how many stores they have?
Yeah.
No? Like 100-something stores. I ran into the owner at Batue something a few weeks ago. I didn't remember, but I met him 10 years ago. And he's like, oh, how do you, we're talking. So like, Chicken Republic. I'm like, okay. I remember they were struggling 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. The business almost shut down because they were doing chicken, South African type chicken things. They've changed now. Meat back.
Jollof rice.
Gizdodo. Right?
Chicken.
You
chicken
localize.
Yeah.
Nigeria is a different animal.
Yeah.
Don't bring Oyinbo and try to superimpose. Yeah, it's true.
You're right.
It's always about community profiling.
Even Chowdeck too. That's what they said that it helped. Like, because a lot of these other Uber Eats type companies would come and then put in pizza, burger, blah, blah, blah. I want Amala. I want it for real. Can you help me get that? If you can help me get that consistently every day, your business is going to scale.
And guys, you guys are the fancy people. I mean, you know, let's not talk about that. Let's not talk about you guys. Or shall I interview you guys? I can flip this and start interviewing you guys. Okay, I want to flip it very soon. I want to like camera zoom around.
There's a camera on you. Right? There's multiple cameras on you.
Right. But I'm saying that we always think about ourselves when we think about the target market. It is not the target market.
Yeah.
Look at ShopRite, right? ShopRite is the place whereby I can go and buy tomatoes for my daily soup without spending, it's not more than 10-20% markup. AC is blowing me. I don't sweat through that experience.
Yeah.
I see regular people, it's a melting pot for everybody. It's the same way if you go to Target, unless you want to be fancy, you're going to, what's the other one? The fancy one.
No, Walmart is basic. Even worse.
What's the other one that they do?
Wait, you
hand-picked
say,
Trader's Joe.
Or Whole Foods.
Whole Foods, I was going to say, yeah.
So we are thinking Whole Foods. We're thinking we should be talking about Walmart.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that, think about the Walmart of everything.
Yeah. Actually, I want Nigeria to have a Costco. If, like, not
see,
that
see,
Costco.
This is the problem.
I wasn't going to say Costco. I'm saying, you know what it is? I want to see someone create. I want Ibano to move to Costco. I want Ibano to be, like, membership.
This is the
problem.
No,
you see. And it's all Niger stuff.
This is the issue.
I love Costco so much.
You see? This is how you go and say, can we have some premium what do you call that thing plantain, right? We want the yellow green No, keep it basic. You fancy people, you know how you're going to get your
and
food.
You don't have the issues.
You don't have those issues.
You have the issues.
But I'm saying that if you make it, I'll give you a simple example. Anybody can wear this product, right? And it wouldn't mean, obviously there are different grades of it, but fundamentally, can I walk to Ebano and get a size XL of this? Already done. I can pick and go.
Yeah.
This is why the fashion industry has failed. And I've been talking about this for God knows over 15 years, right? I've done some fashion, Shark Tank things with the British Council before where they bring their different, and for me, that the model is simple. Respectfully, and these are all my friends, so I'm not yapping anybody. Whether it's Larry Da Silva or Tiffany, like all these people, you are dealing with the chicas. And the HAs of the world.
0.5%.
You're not dealing with the average person who says, how can I get cheap fashion that is well done? That's Zara's model.
Yeah.
So mean that if you own a Zara, you're going to make more money, actually, than all these fancy things you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a $1 billion.
So Zara, guys, let's calm down.
The Walmart of everything.
Let's just do that. Mm. Let people get their stuff.
And also, I think the other part that people don't realize is, because I think sometimes when people hear the Walmart of everything, they're thinking like, you're just trying to water down and keep everything poor.
Mm.
They don't realize that when you raise the base, right, everything above it also goes up, right? So if the problem now is like we're in the bottom of the ocean, let's come above. So let's, if you say the Walmart of everything, I've shopped at Walmart. Any Jeff Bezos can enter Walmart tomorrow. No problem.
That's the point, bro.
And the issue is we don't even have that mindset to begin with, right? It's almost like you feel like a Jeff Bezos has to be in Whole Foods his whole life. No, I've gone to Whole Foods. I've gone to Walmart. And I've never felt any sort of, obviously there's little differences, but you know that there's a baseline standard of a Walmart.
Bro, let's even take it further.
Yeah.
I'm from Kaduna State. We have the best ginger in the world. Literally, we export, right? If I can supply Walmart of everything, ginger, what does that do for my local farmers in the village? They now know that there's a contract that comes every month.
Consistently.
It's valued at this and goes there. Pepper sellers, their supply, think about the supply chain itself. Think about the transport system, the transportation. Think about how it lowers the costs when you massify, when you're moving in masses, the product comes at a lower cost. So it means that the Walmart over time, if it builds that system, is able to get cheaper, better products more efficiently for the average man. So you're not only responding, you're not only getting a cheaper buy, even our pockets, I feel better.
People also don't realize that was China's model too.
Yeah. Right?
How they pulled 800 million people out of poverty. It's like, look, we're not going to be selling EV cars for $100,000 like in the US. We're going to make it $5,000, $10,000. You pull people out of poverty first. And when they're out of poverty, they can now start to aspire. They can now say, okay, cool. I want to wear a customized, or I want an Apple or whatever. But first, give them the actual baseline dignity.
When Chika was saying that Nigeria, they can't afford it. Listen, we're the biggest champagne market. Who's drinking it?
Yeah, Nigerians.
Abi, you go to, okay, again, I don't want to call you guys out. I was going to say Banana Island, but we're not really in Banana Island, are we? Or are we? Or are we? But how much is a plot of land in Banana Island?
It's crazy.
And people are buying it. The place is full.
Yeah.
Every new development there. So what I'm saying is that I think that there's poverty. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But the question then is that the things we do that reduces poverty is the act of inclusion in as many things instead of exclusion, which is what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Right? So if for every Banana Island, let there be the Lekki that has ambitions that can aspire to do that, affordable homes, all this. Look, this is a lot of work, but primarily let's start from... So I'm just simply saying that even with what you guys are doing with the podcast, what you're doing is education.
Yes.
And once I can understand that, really, I don't have to buy this expensive iPad when I can just buy a nice Naimo. Is it Oraimo? There's one brand.
Oraimo
brand that does the same thing. But as I get higher, I can one day say, okay, I want to get fancy and get an iPad. They do the same thing, right? So education is important. I think we don't just have enough information. We're just focused on the high guys. We're not thinking about the average people. And that's the job that government must do. And that's why we have to encourage and get involved in politics, because the more smart people that are educated like us, hopefully they get into power, will find ways to make policies about people, not projects.
Yeah.
We're always talking about projects. I did 500 boreholes.
Airports.
Airport. I built one flyover. Flyover for who? There's no petrol. There's no car. The damn bridge. You know, so anyway.
I want to transition, right? I think our first episode was with MI, actually. Yeah. And in the episode, he mentioned...
Oh, your first ever episode?
Episode, yeah.
Oh,
first
really?
Episode, yeah, MI, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this was in end of March.
Okay.
So yeah, first ever episode was MI. Mm. And in that episode, he talked about when he was first starting and he had come to Lagos.
Mm.
And you told him that, you know, Style Plus at the time were on the way out and he was on the way in. But at the time, Staples was like the biggest. And yeah. he said that he was such a huge fan. And you basically like level set with him, like, fam, they're on the way out, you're on the way in. Mm. The reason why I want to talk about that is that ability to, I always have, my favorite quote is like, a lot of men have eyes, but few have the gift of penetration, right? Mm. Which is like your ability to see past the pattern that's coming and see past what is. How do you think that you developed that within yourself? Was it the family you were raised in? Was it experiences? How are you able to sometimes, not to say that you predict the future, but you're able to just level set and say like, look, I know what this looks like today, but tomorrow there's a shift that's coming.
Yeah, maybe. That's a great question. I, you know, in our business, many people, so the other day I was having a conversation with one of our artists, Tariq, said something, I said, bro, Do this. He said, Laudy, you're just a suit. I said, what?
Yeah. A suit.
A suit. He didn't say any of those words, but it was basically, what do you know about music? So I asked one of my colleagues, I said, tell him what I know about music. because the other role that I played in the early stages is actually A&Ring. To sign an artist, you need to be able to A&R. What is develop the artist. But you only develop things that you see possibilities in the future for, right? So I would say that even the music training is what helps you figure out and say, if I look at this guy today, he's not much. But if I put this, that, and he does this, that, he can be that. And I think over a 20-year journey, we've been able to consistently find people from zero and take them there. Because it's about now understanding people, not necessarily looking at the things that they have. Many people are always excited about, you know, what they see in front of them. And I think that one, I've always been open about people. I'm very, I know I have a bit resting face, as they say, but behind the face, and that's, hey, that's nature, right? You blame God. But behind that is that I'm very interested in understanding people and how they think, right? Because it's what you think that they say, as a man thinketh, so he is. Mm. So if I see that you're thinking wrong, I can't project anything great for you because it's clear that. So let me give you a simple example. This may be a bit controversial, is that when you look at like the leadership in Nigeria, and I wasn't a big fan of the Buhari administration, but I had a lot of respect for the man. Right? And I tell people this story that when I was in, I grew up in Lagos, but I spent the later part of my life in uni in Kaduna, between Kaduna and Abuja. And in the late 90s, there was crazy fuel scarcity in Nigeria. It's crazy. Like, you could be on the line for 3 days. Yeah, 3 days. You couldn't get petrol. So there was a filling station near my house, and we had gone there to go and hustle for petrol as usual. And then Muhammad Buhari drives in. He drove a 504. You guys know what a 504 is?
I remember. We had one.
Yeah. We had one. Yeah, so 504, drove himself.
Peugeot, right? 504 Peugeot? Yes.
Drove into the, he drove, and the place was surrounded with cars. Like, literally, people are fighting, beating each other to get in line. And when he comes in, people look at him like a Muhammad Buhari, and they begin to clear. You know how the Moses parted the Red Sea? The Red Sea was parted that day for Muhammad Buhari. People lifted cars out just out of reverence for who the man was and what he stood for. And I felt that that was very powerful. But my concern was about the fact that when he left leadership, he never actually did a lot in national debate. Never, he almost just came back to himself. So when the elections came and people were talking about that, I wasn't a big fan of that. I just felt that he would be the same kind of person. And many people were against my view. I was definitely one of the minority people, no doubt about that.
This was before he got elected, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I could see. Because you can see who people are, not by what they say, but what they do. And that's a lesson we don't learn.
Over and over.
It's the same thing. It's never failed. I can tell you I am Jesus Christ superstar. I can tell you that now. But have you seen me walk on water? Have you seen the dead?
Some small water to wine for boys. You know, don't.
You can't even do that. They want to walk on water. They're not even converted. You know what I'm saying? So it's almost like even with MI, what I saw in MI was that he was persistent. He would come in every day. hey, boss, what's up? How you doing? Huh? That's some new music for you. And we're just very, very brilliant guy. Very, very intelligent. But I could see that his aspirations were not just that. Right? So I was like, you know what? With the right moves with this dude, he could be something. And I remember an email sent us very long time ago. I said, well, I see what you guys are doing. I like this movement. And he was thinking futuristically. So it wasn't rocket science to know that this guy would make it only if he focused on what he was doing. Right? And I think that is just really across even the industry. When we started Chocolate City, it was the dumbest idea. Mm. People were laughing at us. There was one, like my friends were friends, close friends, like those guys. In fact, one of my bosses said, hey, Aldo, you're a lawyer. How can you be chasing all these artists? Like that? You know, you can get disbarred. They told me that, like, that's how ignorant they
were. Wait, what did you say?
You can get disbarred.
Really?
Yes. That was the perception, yeah. Right? And
everywhere. You're wasting this degree.
You're wasting this degree. What are you doing now? You have a. So that was the story. But for me, was the more you said it, the more I had to enter my heart, not my head. Because your intuition, I always say that your intuition is the voice of God.
Yes.
And it saved me so many times that as I get older, I rely more on that. That is a gut feeling that speaks to you, not in words, but somewhere here, and it resonates with you. So I think I was just able to see that, look, there is something happening in this industry. We don't know where it's going, but we know that's only going to get better. And because the problem was contracts terminable contracts that I resolved, or you're seeing a brilliant guy who does not have enough money to enter a taxi to go home, is that it just reinforced to us the fact that we need to do something about the problem and look ahead of what it could be. You know, so I think that we're blessed, but then sometimes, guys, it's just luck. It's not really brilliant. You know, I would like to say there's some formula. There's no formula. But I would say that if you are in tune with your inner man, we'll tell you, guys, you guys just move back here. Is it really the most rational thing to do? No. If you think about it, and many people tell you nothing, then in a few years' time, when your company is worth $20 billion, they're like, how did they make it? They must have been brilliant. No. You are resilient. You know, so I think I don't want to take credit, but I'll just say that I've always been about people, how they think and what they've done, and that will be how I place my bets on them.
You know, Sam Altman had this quote that I tweet every other day now, where he says, "Do things that increase your surface area of luck," right? Because we know that luck definitely plays a huge role. But what are the things that you're doing that increases your surface area of the luck try finding you? You know, so that's something that I wanted to leave with the audience. I do want to get stories around, because like you said, you were CEO, but you're also A&R, right? You're there when maybe MI comes with maybe the first album, right? Talk about it.
Yeah.
And you're there when you first hear Oleku, right? And this at the time is your friends are making fun of you in the industry, like you might get this bar or whatever. Just tell us stories of that transition period where you're like, there's the MI albums, there's Oleku, and these same friends, though, I'm sure you're hanging out with them, you're at a club, you're at a bar, and these songs are coming out and they're dancing to it.
Yeah.
What was that satisfaction that you felt? Or I don't know if it was satisfaction, but what was the feeling you felt where first they presented you the albums, you've listened to it, you have taste, you know that you are sitting on, this one is hits for sure. That's number one. But two, when your parents, your friends, the perception now started to change, like walk us through that. What did that look like?
Yeah, I mean, there are many stories of those things.
Yeah.
Like I said, I was blessed to have a father who was very futuristic in how he felt. So the day I told myself I'm doing music, he said, yeah, but you should also do film. That's a big play. Because this guy in 1986, at the age of 38, 39, already had these contracts. He was interested in them. And so it was great that in his heart, he was like, so thank God I bought these things. At least he clearly understood it. He clearly understood it, but of course didn't know the details of it. So that was useful. But I think the greatest thing that I found that was influential in my upbringing was my father and my mother. My mother taught me something that was very powerful. She said, Aldo, nobody's greater than you or better than you. But in the same token, you're not greater or better than anyone. And I think that she level set me to give me the confidence to do what I need to do, but to also be respectful of others. Sometimes we go to the extreme. We have a low complex, but you are just Aldo. Number two, I wasn't brought up to think that I'm a Northerner Christian, that I'm just Aldo. I am able to compete anywhere in the world because I am just who I am. I'm not trying to compete with you because I can never be Chika. I can never be you. But I can be the best me. So those things are fundamental in giving you the confidence when everybody says no, for you to know that, you know what, I can only trust myself and my God, right? So that was important. So even when it came to, so when I meet people too, who have that same mindset, I'm excited because that means that you're not going to fail me because you can't fail yourself, mm-hmm. right? That's most important. When you think about betting on people or betting on projects, that I want to bet on somebody who will bet on themselves first, and they don't need me to be them. They don't need to please me for them to achieve their life goals because their life purpose is more important than my life purpose.
Amen.
So when you think about interesting story, Safe. Safe was the breakout hit that took, Crowd Mentality is the first song. And it was always interesting because Crowd Mentality was feedback from me and Paul saying, this is your American rap something, you have to water it down. So I was like, yeah, whatever. And he walks off angry and then comes back with Crowd Mentality. And I'm hearing the lyrics, and I'm like, yo, this is good. But the production was shit. So I made him go back to the studio probably 4 times. So somebody was saying something. I said, look, when I read about Rick Rubin, I understood, in a sense, of course, I'm not a genius at that level, but I understand music very, very well. I understand what it should sound like. So he literally went to the studio 5 different times, and each time he'd come back with a version that I'll say, okay, do this, do this, do this. I don't know how to do it, but I know what it should sound like. So when Crowd Mentality was ready, the minute we played it, the drums were, the bass line was right. Jeremiah Gang's brother produced it. Mm. Right. And that's like 6-7 versions later. And then, Safe. When Safe came out, MI called, because we have very interesting relationship. Most of the artists, early artists in Chocolate, say, oh God, we have to go and see Aldo and submit that music. Because Aldo will tell you about it. I'm not just telling you, I know the music as much as you do. I may not know how to sing, but I know that this doesn't sound well. Like Oleku, we had to change the verse. I asked him to change the whole stanza on Oleku. Mm. We changed the production. I told him, I was at BET with MI when Ice Prince sent me the song. I said, Ice Prince, you need to put out a single. And he sent me Oleku. And again, like I have all these versions, I can play the versions. The original version was just monotonous. And I said, no, this is not ready. But boss, I need to put out a song. I said, okay, change the verse. I'm going to change the verse. Which rappers rarely do? Do you know what I'm saying? For a rapper to change his verse? Why you tell a rapper to change the verse? But he did because, and it worked better because the second verse was, I can't remember what it was, but I have the version somewhere. And then I called MI one day because we were trying to get Jesse to finish the production. Jesse did the song, they said literally in 30 seconds, and never touched the song again, right? Because Jesse was hard to get by. So like, we were chasing Jesse for weeks, we couldn't get him. So I just called MI, like, look. And MI's specialty is he knows how to finish songs, right? He knows how to finish, he knows what to do with the song. So I'm like, okay, I think that there needs to be some breaks. I think there's something about the production, I think there's two, this monotony. Anyway, so they do the breaks and Abuchi, who's now CEO of Chocolate City, makes and master the song. So if you hear the original version of Oleku and the 3 other versions, you know that there's no way that song would have had the same impact. But that was because there's a chemistry and a trust that the artist knows that, you know what you're talking about. Mm. And you cannot CV that. You have to experience that. And then even with Safe, but this is a flip. With Safe, when he brought the song, 5 minutes from the song, I was like, nigga, I like the rap. Brilliant. But it's too long. Radio's not going to play it. So I said, no, it's going to play. I said, can you cut down the song? Back and forth. So MI said, I'll do, trust me. I said, okay. That word changed everything. He said, trust me. You know? So I said, okay, go with it. And it was the right call. Ara, Good Morning. So I was a fan of Good Morning. I don't really care for Ara. But by that time, the team had become bigger. So we had other A&Rs and all stuff like that. Of course, the final call is the CEO. He says, yes or no. And we're sitting down listening to the song. And we had produced a legendary beat, I think I did Ara. And Good Morning was Jesse Jags. And so we're going back and forth. And the team said, Ara's the song. So I said, you guys, we did a vote. They said they won. I said, okay, let's go around. And it was the right call. So there's no genius. There's no, you know, sometimes it's a gut feeling. But as these things were happening, the same people who were laughing at me are now saying, in fact, one of them asked me for a record contract. I said, what? You were the same guys laughing literally behind me.
Oh, saying, yeah, but they want to sing now, or they want to rap now.
Well, they're trying to sign artists.
Oh, okay.
The same artists that they were laughing at. And I think that's a lesson that we all have to learn. Look, your vision is your vision because you are the one who's envisioning it. You can't explain, no matter how much you explain your vision. Okay, now, I've heard of Afropolitan. I don't know, they're such lush. Anyway, let's not talk about that. But I could never know the lushness until I came here.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about this thing, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have the same experience. I don't have the lenses. And many people have failed and lost businesses because they're focused on a mentor, on a podcast, or some guy who wakes up and says, you can't do it. Your family has always failed. They pre-programmed you, right, to fail. Meanwhile, your vision is your vision. You are the one seeing it. They can't see what you're seeing. And if they see, they're not seeing in the same perspective, right? Very smallest story. Literally 3 years ago, I was going from New York to Atlanta or something. And I got in the seat and then I had a chance to, because my status or whatever, they gave me the option of either Delta Comfort or regular. The seats I like window seats. I don't know why, because I'm scared of flying half the time. But I just feel like if I look outside and I'm about to cross, I can say a quick prayer or jump out of the parachute. I don't know. So they gave me my usual seat and they said, but I could upgrade, but I had to be in the middle. Ooh. So I was like, you know, but more leg room. It's like, yeah, I'll just go Delta Comfort. So I'm seat 12, A, B, C. I'm seat B. And then, you know, sometimes when you're in the plane and you're reading, and just your mind is wandering. I just look up and I can see the guy that's on the other side and I can see his phone. Then I can read everything he's typing. Then I catch myself, I'm like, why am I? So I just look to the left to see if the guy could see that. I was seeing, looking at that guy's thing or the guy here. And I realized that they couldn't see what I was seeing. I realized the guy in front of him could not even see the phone.
So your angle.
I was the only person who could see the phone. And even his guy next to him could not see the phone like I could. Then I said to myself, but what if there's an incident that happened? And they said, who stole something in rule 11 or rule 12? And they asked me, do you know that I would have a different variation of the story than the guy next to me? So we're all in the same line. If we're going at the same space and time, but we have different experiences. And what it showed me was that that's life.
Mm.
People, placement, and perspectives. So you have to be like the Chinese, like the elephant. It's still the same thing around the elephant. It feels like it's a long leg. Is that if you're doing your life and you're living it off other people's perspective, you're not in that position.
Mm.
And unless you're in a certain position, you can never see that perspective. And unless you understand the people, you can never be well positioned for the thing that you're looking at. So leadership is this, is sitting down in your position and taking other people's perspectives.
Mm.
And the whole sum of those perspectives now gives you almost like a neutral path for you to make a decision.
Can you speak a bit more? Because you're already touching on it, but the idea of, and this is for, again, the founders and the leaders and people who are watching this podcast and people who aspire to be in these positions. But the term I call it is like your wilderness moment, right? Where it's like Jesus had to spend 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness. Noah literally had to stay there and they mocked and they laughed and everything, but he had to hold his vision throughout that period, right? What does it look like to be like a frequency holder through that entire period? And what advice do you have for the people who are like, I've been given this vision. I know what it is. My parents are laughing at me. My family's laughing at me. My friends are laughing at me. We're being mocked. But you know that this is something that you have to hold all through it. What advice and what perspectives can you share on that? And do you have any story of times you've had to, aside from the Chocolate City experience, you've also had to reinvent multiple times even through that.
Yeah.
Can you share some stories that can also help give perspective on that?
Look, there are tons of stories. I don't want your podcast to become, you know, like 17 seasons. There's so many stories. But I'll say that a moment for me, I'm actually writing a book right now. And so writing it, I just recounted some of these experiences. There was a wilderness moment. Sorry. It's 2004. I have left the law practice. I'm working now as a legal consultant for a leasing company. I've just taken a loan to pay for an arbitration course, which the company should have paid for, but they said no, they're not paying for it. So I'm taking almost 3/4 of my salary is going to pay that debt for the course. And my car, 190 battered Mercedes-Benz, wasn't that battered, but it was not premium. The engine had just knocked. So I'm in debt. I now raise more money to fix the car. So it's April 2004. I'm like, I'm just going to go for Easter and hang out with my family and just forget about the stress of Abuja. Because then I was in Abuja at the time. I'd finished law school. I'd been in practice for 3 years. So on the way, I'm literally 15 minutes to my hometown. And next thing I hear, poof, the gasket blows. The car's overheating. And I just gleefully passed my friend who was going to the village as well. He was driving a Toyota. So I'm showing my Mercedes-Benz, you know. So the car, I had to park the car, open the thing, you know, thing. And I'm just like, gosh. So my friend parks and I'm like, are you okay? I'm like, you know, the race is not for the swift. You know, literally. So I walk, I take so I ask a kid, I said, where can I get water? So some guy says, just go to the well, there's somewhere there. So I walk to the well. And as I'm fetching water, I'm like, God, what kind of life is this? You know what I'm saying? Like, I know that there's something that you want me to do. And I know I'm not meant to live this life. A few weeks before that, my father had called me and said, look, the Judicial Service Commission is hiring magistrates. And magistrate court judges. I was 6-7 years in the bar, something like that. So I could apply for that. Maybe three. No, it wasn't 6-7 years now. But they were doing something around the lower court system. And he said, just apply. So I just taught myself and I just envisioned myself in Kaduna State. I was just living in one compound. I have one dead Mercedes-Benz 200. I have maybe one Beetle for the wife. I'd have maybe 7 children roaming around naked with their belly buttons. Because, of course, judges aren't paid well. They're very paid with a paywall, especially in the state place. So I'm just like, probably drinking burkutu. You guys know what burkutu is?
Yeah, I know what burkutu is. Like,
probably just drinking burkutu with a big pot belly, you know, wearing wrapper and sitting in that compound, batting with flies because there's no NEPA. And I envisioned that that's what would happen if I took that job. So in my head, I'm like, no, but I'm meant for more than that. It's clear that God always told me that there's something more you can do, more impact. Not necessarily about being wealthy, but just your life cannot just go like that with no real impact. So I told God I said, if you don't change my life in a year, I'm going to go and take that job. Mm. I told him it was a threat and a prayer. Now more a prayer than a threat, obviously, because who's going to survive that threat? And I literally walked, and literally in a year's time, Chocolate City we already had a top 10 hit in Lagos. Literally in a year. By April 2005, because Easter is April, May, isn't it? Right? Yeah. Where? But it was a very pivotal moment because I think many things happen. I think that's the power of when we talk about it. Americans call it affirmations. Mm-hmm. I call it prayer. People talk about going to your shrink. I think communication with God is the greatest therapy you can have in your life because there's a correlation between the things you say and how they manifest. That's why it's important for you to say it. And that's why also you have to care about things you say. Because the more you say it, you're connecting with the elements and they can manifest.
Yeah.
You know, so that was for me, I always call that the turnkey moment in my life because everything was down and in less than a year, everything changed. Because immediately they soon transferred me later that year and said, you have to move to Lagos. So even though I wasn't happy about it, I have a car, I have a place. Now I have to move to a place I don't have a car. I've gone to see with a friend. They're not going to give me accommodation. But guess what? Perfect time. You already signed Jeremiah Gang. So you can promote him in Lagos, which is where he needs to be.
Mm.
So again, perspectives. I could have looked at that as a downgrade, but my perspective was that that's an opportunity. You know, and that, I think that's punctuated my whole life. I mean, I've had a very interesting life. I've I was in exile. We talked about that, and all that. And this was from what conviction still. It was that the what was happening, and incidentally, that's what Trump is talking about today. The things I talked about in 2017, that there is complicity in how there's a mix of religious and ethnic violence in certain parts of Nigeria, which the government can do much more to protect. And the response was, lock him, you know, persecute him and make sure nothing happens for him. But it was just a lone voice in the wilderness. And I knew that many people warned me, don't do this. Like, this is dangerous. I'm like, the truth is that what is the point of having a voice if you can't sing? Right? These platforms are not for us. Yeah. Your wealth is not for you. Afropolitan is not yours, guys. Respectfully speaking, it's not for you. Okay. It's for us. Right? And that's your purpose. Because you don't, if you guys just want to hear yourselves talk, you can't.
You don't need a microphone.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, you don't actually need a microphone. You shouldn't be using a microphone. Yeah. But the point is that for us. So at that time, it was very daunting because I'm having phones tapped. People are following you. People are calling you. Be careful. This, that, like that. You know, you're thrown in jail twice. You're sick. They're, like, all sorts of things.
Just for saying
high level connivance. Yeah. And but when I look at it now, I'm like, you know, it doesn't really matter. The key thing is, because sometimes we make so much, we think we're that important. We're not that important. Mm-hmm. Guys, every day people are dying. A brigadier general was shot live for all of us. Right? There are people that walk across the street just to buy gala and they're killed. So death is not even that great as we... It's painful to our loved ones. The person is gone, is gone. So if we don't know how much time we have, and if we don't know how much time we even have the opportunity to say what we have to, because things will change too. Mm. What you guys are doing now, in 5 years' time, you'll definitely not be doing the same thing. Yeah. It'll be another level. Maybe some huge studio with... It should be some huge studio with 5,000 staff working on your scripts and things like that. But you would have risen above certain things that you wouldn't talk about today. Mm. So we must use the time and the opportunity because it may change and we may be able to do that.
So we're going to transition into our rapid fire segment. But before that, I wanted to get your thoughts on what is their incentive? Because I think sometimes the average Nigerian citizen hearing these things, it's like, yes, we believe that there's complicity, but what is the incentive for a government or leaders to sit by and watch their own citizens getting killed? And funding that or enabling it, like, what is it? Like, what is the incentive? Like, I think Warren Buffett has this quote where it's like, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome, right? What is the incentive, or what do you think is the incentive?
So I found a book in my father's library literally 2 weeks ago. I was in Kaduna, and it's called The Manipulation of Religion in Nigeria. It was written in 1987. And it chronicles articles and writings from 1977, or like a 10-year period. It's written by a guy called Professor Bala Usman. Okay. And it's a very, like, I'm not done with it. I'm actually reading as we speak. But it just reading the first few chapters, it's clear that this is, it's not about the last government or this government. It's a global attack on Nigeria. Because of what Nigeria stands to be. Do you know what I'm saying? If you destabilize Nigeria, Africa is automatically destabilized. And the numbers show you. You're the biggest economy in Africa. If you're destabilized, how many people? If Nigeria collapsed today, 120 million people are going to find a way around Africa. Who can absorb them?
Nobody.
So you've disrupted. That's just one perspective. Second, these are one of the most talented black people on planet Earth. We knew it. So if we keep them in disarray, you're probably, I don't know, I mean, you're not from the same state for sure, right? Uh-huh. And we're already intermarried, we're already fused. How do you get us apart? By using the fundamentals. Religion has always been manipulated from...
The Crusades.
Exactly, right? For the use of political elites. So it's not necessarily even like there's some international interference, but it's about political elitism. Mm. How do we separate the people? By saying, oh, you're a Hausa, you're a Malam, you're an idiot. I get pissed off. You're Igbo, you like money too much. You're Yoruba, you like to party. Like, these are, but they keep doing that so that we're never together. Even the Bible says that if these people are of one voice, there's nothing they can do. So as long as we're not on one voice, we are never going to get to that point of the pinnacle that Nigeria deserves to be. So that's it. It's a bigger play around Nigeria because of its significance to the future. Not necessarily that they hate anybody in particular.
I want to talk about why aunties are so important to African history. Aunties represent curators of the African experience, and oftentimes they have been unacknowledged. They have literally held our archives before they were archives. They were literally institutions before we had institutions. They held so many important cultural artifacts, such as the way we braid our hair, the recipes of our cookings. They represent abundance. There's literally a reason why we call an African culture rich aunties. And we believe that with partnering with Anthony, we're able to showcase this type of history through art. So to connect to African history and get a piece of the Anthony and Afropolitan collection called Auntie, make sure to click the link in the description. And this is your way you can support our channel.
Real quick, I want to talk to you about Quill. So prior to Quill, I would usually have to go into a meeting with an AI note taker, download the transcript after the meeting, and then take it to ChatGPT to perform tasks. But with Quill now, you no longer have to do all that. It sits in the meeting with you. Nobody necessarily knows it's there. It's not a bot. It's localized to your desktop. And then it starts to perform tasks. So you can have it literally do a PRD for you, which is a product requirement document. You can have it do linear tasks. You could also have it connected to your Notion, and it's performing tasks. So in your Notion, you can have it write an event proposal for you. Like, it just does tasks. So it basically turns your conversations into action. Try it, right? We have the link in the show notes, quillmeetings.com. So we're going to transition to our rapid fire segment, which is where we ask your question. And the first thought that comes into your mind, that's what you have to give to us, right?
Oh, Lord.
What is the best Nigerian hip hop album of all time?
Jesus.
No pressure.
There's a lot of pressure. Hip hop album.
Yeah, hip hop.
I see you talk about it.
I would agree. One artist you wish you had signed but didn't?
Duncan Mighty.
Really?
Oh, I love Duncan Mighty.
That's my
Mighty.
G.
I love he's Duncan Mighty.
Wait, not Wizkid?
What?
But Chocolate City was supposed to sign Wizkid, or am I making that
no,
up?
Am I connected Wizkid with Banky?
Okay.
And there was an opportunity, but we were also just trying to get MI on the road. Right. I never discovered Wizkid till a bit much later, but to be honest, I don't think he would have thrived well in Chocolate City at the time. That's the truth. So So I love him, but I think he's really one of the greatest, like, he's pure talent, but the homes don't always work. So,
and that Duncan Mighty, his songs, I don't know, I was listening to more yesterday, and it just feels very, what's the word? I want to use the word sweet, but it's more than that. It's like, you know, when
it's melodic, it's almost spiritual in the way he sings. He is a sound engineer extraordinaire.
Okay.
So when you hear the mix of his songs, it's ridiculous. Then you have to think about the harmonization, how he harmonizes songs and what he talks about. Right, he's very unique. So that's why you find. I mean, if you really want to know how bad this guy is, Wizkid and him, interesting. You're talking about Wizkid. I was talking about him. Wizkid and him have a song together, "Fake Love." Go and listen to Wizkid. Is hard when Wizkid sings. It's hard to really follow him up in the same. But look at what he did. He's been. So that's the guy I wish I had. Always.
Is there a particular book that has influenced your mindset that you'd recommend?
For the 8 Laws of Power.
48 Laws of Power. Awesome. Should artists own their masters from day one, or do labels deserve equity for investments?
Yeah, I think that there's... I mean, the model has changed. You can actually just license your masters for 15, 20 years and it reverts you. I would say that that's the most equitable thing, simply because the label is able to recoup their investment. Because remember, the money doesn't come immediately. You can... The artists that we signed, we recouped 10 years later, to be honest. That's break even. But remember that the Naira value has dipped. Good. So I've actually lost money, even if I recouped, technically speaking. So I need the time to recoup. But I think it's great that that is your retirement plan for your children. So reversing your rights can be done. Or you sell 50%, you keep 50%. There are many ways to do it.
You've seen the trend of a lot of private equity firms buying the publishing of some of the artists, especially a lot of them globally. What do you think, first of all, just for our audience, but they might not even know what's going on, can you give your thoughts on that? But also, what does that look like extrapolating into the future, maybe even on the Africa side of things? Is there a world in which some private equity firms can now start coming into Africa and say, okay, here's a big check?
Maven and Kupanda, that's private equity.
Yeah.
Right. Even as we have a partner, we've done two projects with, we've done the Founders Fund we just launched, Argent Hill Capital. We're equity partners in that. When we did CCX, the lounge, we're equity partners in that. So they're already getting into the space. You just need to be comfortable with the fact that you have the structure, you have the team, and you are able to keep records to a certain level. So it's happening. There's a WIPO report that's coming out next year. I had the opportunity to kind of peer review it and look at what the global perspective looks like. Over the past 5 years, $22 billion has been put into acquiring catalog. Because they call them asset-backed securities now. It's a tangible product as gold. Real estate, as yeah. gold as anything now. And it's not very affected by recession or interest. And you have a steady kind of return on investment. So with streaming guarantees the provenance of the track, and you can definitely use that for loans, advances, or even equity.
Would you say streaming was good or bad for the music industry, especially compared to the fact that some artists say they used to make more before streaming?
It's good, Joe.
You think it's good?
It's good we never really made money from stream selling music for the first 10, 12 years, apart from Ring Back Tunes. Where? You put the song on the CD, Tiju pirated 10 million copies everywhere. You're not seeing any money. But now we're actually making money, and we're actually making money in foreign currency as well and local currency. So for any, I don't think any artist, especially in this part of the world, can say they made more money prior to this period than now. Mm. It's almost impossible.
You're a hip hop head, so I want to know, what's your favorite hip hop song?
Oh God, why would you do that?
This is
wicked. God. Where'd I even start? No, this is not fair.
Or maybe you have like ones for different moods. Like maybe you have like one for this mood, one for that mood.
So hip hop song. My favorite hip hop song of all time that I've listened to a billion times is either Electric Relaxation, A Tribe Called Quest, or Sucker Nigga, Tribe Called Quest. All of them will be Tribe Called Quest. Don't worry about that. All of them. Mm. Literally. So I'm a bit obsessed, but yeah.
Okay. And Chika just reminded me, I'm a hip hop head, obviously, and I obviously swear by Jay-Z all the time. I want to give you a platform to give us your perspective on Jay and the moves he's made, as well as an artist or as a business owner. And what are your perspective of what that looks like for even, you know, us coming up as young, black, we're still necessarily young black men in the world, but what is your perspective on Jay?
I think he's exemplary. You know, when you hear the stuff about Puffy and all that, I used to be a big Puffy fan. I felt he was, you know, I'm sure a lot of us were, because it was this,
from a business perspective,
this guy was, you know, and he was much richer than Jay-Z, moved in business really quickly. But what I found out, especially when I was, you know, when I was running the esports company in New York and just got closer to all these people and meeting these people, was that he was all about himself. He was just about himself. Forget what you're hearing now. It was obvious, because if you look at Jay, there's an ecosystem. There are people who he empowered. Very clear, like tangible. They have jobs, they have companies, they're making money. It's very clear that he had other people. So if anything happened to Jay, there's a whole ton of people that will come and say, no, this is our guy, we're not going to let it. And with Puffy, I mean, before all this stuff, I just kept thinking, like, who's he made?
Who have you empowered?
No one. Like, no one. Who?
That's true.
Yeah, I'm struggling.
No one.
Yeah, I'm struggling. Random divert. Remember Fonsworth Bentley? I can't find him. I can't. Like, he literally has scrubbed himself off the internet.
Look at Mace.
What did he do?
Look at Mace.
Yeah.
Look at
Mace made himself way after. Like he had to do a full revamp. No,
zero. Yeah. Craig Mack died. He didn't go for the funeral. Do you know what I'm saying? So when you look at that, like even big, of course, later on now we're not hearing the real stuff. But enough about him. The lesson for me is that it always has to be about the people. So one of the things that I did very, very deliberately, even early on with Chocolate City, was that I wasn't, it's not an Aldo movement. It's our movement. Now imagine, and I tell them, and this is a lesson I want entrepreneurs to learn. I talk about it all the time. I talk about collaborations and partnerships. The most important thing. If I was away for 7-8 years, so someone was asking me, like, so where have you been? Like, oh, I've been in the States. So how are you running the company? Like, I have a team. They're not just team, they're co-owners with me. So if it falls, they lose. So it's smartness that Jay-Z is sharing his thing with other people. They will not let it fail because they have a stake. But if all you're doing is, oh, I just want to use you and plug in, then what happens when something happens to you? And you can see that's what happened with Jay-Z. And even they were accused of similar things, weren't they? What happened with Jay-Z?
You see the difference.
You can see how it moved because he was deliberate. He built, look, there's some Americans one time I met somebody like, oh, come to the office because our office was a Rock Nation. Like, oh, come to the office. Like, where's your office? Like Rock Nation, Rock Nation? I say, yeah. They could not believe that they got a chance to enter Rock Nation building. It was a big deal. I didn't understand it because obviously I've been coming there for a while. So, you know, where you, it's like this fancy place that you guys have now, you know, like same kind of feel. I'm not going to let you guys rest. Why? Come here like, oh, what? You know, but my point is that you have built something that community has taken part of. Diddy was just about Rocco, what's that thing? Sean John. It's just about himself.
Bad Boy, yeah.
You know, hubris. Where's the community? Where are the people? And for me, that's Jay-Z's greatest legacy. It's not his hip-hop. It's not the rap. It's not that. It's that people around him shared in his success. Mm. And that's a lesson for all of us that it cannot be, if forever and ever is always about I'll do, then you failed.
Yeah.
You failed.
And I would say just last thing before I get to my last question is it can't be performative because when you watch the Diddy documentary, I'll never forget, he went outside, started dapping everybody up, acting like he was part of the community. He literally came out. He's like, where is the hand sanitizer? I touched too many people. Like, I got to literally bathe myself.
I'm shy about that.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's really crazy. So you're right. Like, and it's funny because I think we were talking about it the other day in the car. Like,
you can't fake community.
Yeah. And Jay-Z has literally built his close friends are not even people you know. Right. But he's employed them. So like, yeah, like I definitely feel like that's really key.
I was telling Chica too, like when I read the Jay-Z allegations the first time, right? I said to her, I didn't believe it. And I didn't necessarily even need to be told not to believe it. And then when he came out and you could like the first press or whatever he did, you could hear his voice in it. And for those of us who listen to his music, it was like, listen, we're not shocked at the response. We're not shocked at how you've responded. And those of us who understood your essence were never even moved because we knew this is a game that's happening in this particular time. And I was saying to her, like, compare that to when the same thing happened with Diddy. It wasn't a thing where before the video came out, we didn't really know yes or no, but you could tell people were like, so many people have come out to say that you've done other things, Sha, so this might not be beyond the pale.
Yeah.
But as soon as that video came out.
Bro, but let me double click on that.
Yeah.
Guys, listen, think about this. There's been a trend in America whereby black people, when they get to a certain level.
Yeah.
Look at it. There are many, many stories. You know them. I mean, no need to call them. But how come this one? Because the truth is that with the endorsement deals and all he has done, they would have cut him off immediately. Just off the allegation, you're done. But it was that there's so many people that have been planted.
Stakeholders.
Who are stakeholders? When I got arrested, it was trending for maybe 2 days. People from everywhere were calling. And I didn't realize that I even had stakeholders. Till today when I walked, like, oh, how do we free? How do we do the campaign? But what were they buying into? The perceived integrity of the person. So we must build and also protect and preserve our integrity. Because what happens now is that that authenticity will fall through the cracks. Jay-Z may not be yo everywhere, but the truth is that when he shows up, he does show up for a reason, and everyone has benefited. Is it taxes paid? Is it justice systems? Is it scholarships? Is it that? What did Puffy ever do? So the questions we have to ask ourselves today is, as we're building these empires, what is our legacy? What will people say, because you existed, we exist? Mm. That's what founders should also understand. Community impact.
Mm.
Always.
Well, the last question we ask every single guest on this podcast is, who do you want to see in that chair and whose story needs to be told?
So I think a really interesting person to talk with is Charles Opalike.
We've just said that.
You heard that, right?
We just said that a week ago. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an interesting person. So I used to do this during COVID, Clubhouse days. I used to do this. Yeah, I didn't talk about that, actually.
Yeah.
What happened to Clubhouse?
You know, hold on. Let me just say a quick thing, because I had the second largest club, actually women on Clubhouse. And I spoke to the Clubhouse team, right? And they were like, yeah, because they hit a like movement.
Mm.
And then essentially they were about to eventually start funding people, right? Which mm-hmm. is where like any real social app is supposed to go. You have to monetize the app. And so they spoke to me and they were like, yeah, you're a shoo-in. We're going to make sure we put money behind your program. Mm. Because Oprah's team reached out to me. The Red Table reached out to me. Washington Post
really?
Reached out to me. Oh, I was on a...
What happened? Live.
Well, Clubhouse pulled a rug underneath every single creator that was serious on the app. And instead, they said, we're going to put money behind TikTokers and get them to come on the app and start shows.
So my perspective, it's because I was early. I was one of the first 5,000 people there.
Yeah,
I think, and I've seen this in different environments, I think platforms mistake the difference between community people and creators. And I'll explain what I mean by that.
Okay.
So sometimes your biggest power users on your platform are not necessarily creators. They're people who are community builders who are like, hey, I know how to get people in, right? And we know how to entertain them.
Mm.
Creators are like, I create content and then the audience comes.
Mm.
Clubhouse confused its platform for being TikTok when it was really more of a community platform. Mm. And the reason for that is when I first got onto Clubhouse, my first impression was, I cannot believe the white man allowed a platform like this to exist. The reason why is, up until Clubhouse, there has never been a platform that you could gather the most influential voices of black people globally at one time. True. I'm like, do you realize how dangerous this is? Because now what this means is, in all those Afropolitan rooms, I could have Audu in Atlanta, the same Audu in New Zealand, the same Audu in Australia, all talking at the same time in real time, making plans, investing, moving like that. So that was the community angle. And there were obviously multiple communities as well. The problem, though, was they were still thinking about it from a myopic perspective of, like, there's TikTok, there's Facebook, there's advertising. How do we monetize?
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Why not create your Clubhouse?
You know, you mean build it, right?
Yeah, why not?
So, you know, it's so funny. That's what inspired what we said when
I was No, I know. Hey, I follow your trajectory. Exactly. But I'm saying even now.
Yeah.
Because what you said here is very powerful.
Mm.
You're saying that. Because I missed that. I missed the fact that sometimes, I mean, remember one time, who was it on the house? Somebody big, though.
Yeah.
I think was Martin, no, what's it, Keith? Kevin Hart.
Yeah, Kevin Hart, yes.
That they're like, yeah, nigga, you ain't funny. Like,
yeah.
You remember?
Yeah, I remember that.
But
the
point is that he came there because even he wanted community.
No, but he was an investor, too.
Good. So I'm saying, why not still do that? Because here's the problem.
Mm.
As you started speaking, I was going to say, this is what we talked about. They own the platform.
Mm.
They yank the rug.
Mm.
And then they make you lose an opportunity.
They deprioritize our rooms.
But imagine what would have happened if it was your platform.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that there's still an opportunity there still. People still want to engage. And that is that's the person I want to see. So next person I want to see on this seat is you guys. And I'll be on that part. And I'll be talking about what you guys... No, but seriously, think about it.
Yeah,
I think it's a huge opportunity. You guys are building... You already know how to do the community.
Yeah.
That's not your problem. And the infrastructure is already kind of built. Yeah. It's not rocket science anymore.
No, it's not.
So maybe you guys think about that. But yeah, that's amazing.
So Charles Okpale, and then Eche and Chica.
Yeah, Eche and Chica. Okay. And I'm going to be the host.
Okay.
Okay. Deal?
Deal.
Let's make it happen.
You guys, make it happen. You got this part.
No, right? No problem. I mean, we're here now.
Okay. You're good because I like when people who have a legal background interview because I think they know how to get into the questions and the you know how to get into nitty gritty.
That litigation background.
Yeah, so you know how to navigate.
Yeah, that's how you guys. Okay. No worries, but thanks for having me.
Yes. No, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.